This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Botanic Garden, a stunning 52-acre garden in the heart of Brooklyn, featuring spectacular plant displays and inspiring public programs year-round. Learn more at bbg.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers in the food industry. Our guest this week is Michael Pollack, who's already laughing. So it's a good introduction. I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch. My co-host, Valerie, is off having adventures in Paris and Portland.
That's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, I know. I'm stuck here in Brooklyn. So she's
sourcing, vacationing,
Well, she was baking in Paris, and I highly recommend to anybody who's interested, check out her Instagram, Foodie in New York, and she's been posting pictures of all the incredible baked goods that she's been cranking out.
She's
in Paris.
She was in Paris.
I think today she's in Portland. She's speaking at a conference. She's doing glamorous things, and we're here in the studio.
This is pretty glamorous.
It's all right. My guest is Michael Pollack, who is the managing director, managing director. Yeah, okay. Not a co-founder, but as close as possible to a co-founder.
Unpaid summer intern.
The first unpaid summer intern at the Brooklyn...
The first intern. Unpaid.
At the Brooklyn Roasting Company.
For Brooklyn Roasting Company.
Yes. So you have had a pretty diverse career, and much more so than a lot of our guests. And, you know, we've had a fair number of people in their 30s and 40s, and you've had more career than they have.
I'm a multiple of their age, so right. Appropriately so.
And I think one of the other things that's particularly interesting about your this part of your story, because your story has a lot of parts to
yes.
it, is the age at which you got involved at Brooklyn Roasting Company.
Yes, I was 59. Years old at the
time. So later than most of the career changers we have interviewed.
Well, it's a brave new world.
Yeah, it is.
And you know, being engaged, the ability to find something to do that you love is rare and special. And probably more people sort of being given the opportunity to pursue that. And I imagine those are the people at whatever age. That you mostly meet with,
but you did change careers several times.
Oh yes,
not in food.
No,
which is
no.
what brings us together today. But
correct.
But in lots of other
many
fields.
Many other things.
So we're going to try to cover some of that in this interview. But let's start where we are,
yes.
which is coffee and the Brooklyn
yes.
Roasting Company.
Yes.
Just give us an introduction. What is Brooklyn Roasting now? What was it 10 years ago when it started? And
so, let's see. Brooklyn Roasting was started by my business partner, Jim Munson, a Williamsburg resident for most of his New York life. He had been an employee at the Brooklyn Brewery and had, I guess, ended up as sales manager. For them. he was, and self-describes, an amazing palate. He was chairman of the American Food and Beverage. So he has a great palate. So from a perspective, talking about something that's consumed, we had a great simpatico moment during my interview. Yeah.
So let's talk about that story. At the age of 59, you answered an ad for an intern.
Well, so I was through no desire, but let's say forces stronger than myself, as I like to say. I was roasting coffee in my apartment in downtown Manhattan.
Which your neighbors loved, I'm sure.
They did not, oddly enough. The smell of coffee roasting is different than the smell of roasted coffee. And it's very particular, and most people don't necessarily... If you're a coffee roaster, you anywhere you go, you pick it up, and it's the scent that sort of drives us. But most people do not particularly like it. It's different until the very end to roasted coffee. And so I had a little mail order business, so every month I would roast 8-ounce packets for 25 people and send that out. And my family didn't actually, were not so thrilled that I'd sort of started this, because roasting inside, I had my little roaster on my windowsill with incense burning and ceiling fans. It was like a shrine to coffee. And so I was on my computer one day, and NBC at that time had a sort of, I guess, a video blog called The Feast, and they highlighted new businesses in the food industry, and they did a story on this company called Brooklyn Roasting. And so, as fate would have it, I found they had a website, and they had a telephone number. So I called up, and voice on the other side, Brooklyn Roasting, I see you started a business. Do you need any help? And as you revealed, I was, in fact, 59 years old. I would describe as a unbelievably blessed life. And so I had a business that I had sold and arranged with my wife to take a few years off, stay-at-home father for one daughter and then another daughter, and it sort of tumbled into 26 years of not working. When I say not working, not working. So there were things that okay. I did, but I did with never the idea of making money. And so, which oddly enough, being an unpaid summer intern was not exactly a money-making idea. But I digress. And so, I said, you started a business, do you need any help? And he said, I'm about to place an ad for an unpaid summer intern. And 59, it was not exactly what I was hoping for, but I said, you know what? I got time on my hand. So I arranged for an interview in Williamsburg. I lived, as I said, in downtown Manhattan, and bicycled into Williamsburg, and I get to the address on North 10th Street, and on the directory is nothing that says Brooklyn Roasting. And I go, oh, God, I can't believe this. I'm in Williamsburg. And so I look on my phone. They have a website and the name Jim Munson, and there it is on the buzzer. And so I push the buzzer. The door opens, and I go from my loft space in downtown Manhattan into a really funky Williamsburg loft filled with coffee equipment. And the first and one of the few, actually a 5-gallon French press that actually could and would later on function to make big patch coffee in a way that most people, that the Bodum company that actually made it never intended it to be used in coffee service, because the spout was really small. But if nothing else, we were very creative and we figured out how to work around anything that was stopping us doing what we were doing, which was sourcing and roasting extraordinary coffees from around the world, with an eye for the importance of where in the world coffee comes from. So our coffees are now, as a company, we're 90% fair trade certified, which is very important, especially as climate and everything else in the world sort of fights against farming families who actually literally have the hardest job in the whole supply chain. On that side, and we had, in fact, acquired what was the most fuel-efficient roaster in the world, which was made out in Santa Rosa, California. So no heat coming off the roaster. And so during my internship, it was revealed two things. One, that we had found a location to actually start roasting coffee. Two, we had agreed to acquire a roaster from aforementioned Loring Company in Santa Rosa, California. And we were going to go out in late August because the roaster was being constructed and there was a Finnish roaster in place, so I could, because I was given the unbelievable opportunity to be the original roaster.
And what brought you to coffee in the first place? You'd been roasting in your kitchen, but where did that interest come from?
When you say about the paths and all kinds of, let's see. So coffee in my own life, I'm about to be 21. I loved coffee candy. I loved coffee ice cream. I was not a coffee drinker. There was a amazing Dutch coffee called Hopjes, which I still, whenever I go to Copenhagen, I bring back. So I was a coffee candy lover. And yeah, it's...
You were trying to make it as a stand-up comic at the time.
I tried to make it, yes.
You'd ended your career as a stand-up comic.
I ended my career as a stand-up comic. I went into sales. Actually, I went into a job. I took a job to write a sales manual because I had also tried to go into advertising at the time, to write a sales manual for a coffee company. By the time I finished the manual, I knew as much, if not more, than all of the people in sales about the products that we were offering. I was given an opportunity to try sales. Sales and stand-up comedy are not that different. And actually, the laughter in sales is a much better laugh than in comedy, because in sales you laugh when you sign a deal or close a deal, and that's a good feeling.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
So was coffee sort of a current in your life at that point? Were you?
I was drinking coffee because, as I said, going into the age of 21. I decided I needed to learn how to drink coffee and how to drink whiskey. And so...
Important skills for
a
young New Yorker.
A young New Yorker. And on my way off into going to school in Buffalo. And so Buffalo, not exactly coffee, chicken wing. I was not a... I ate differently than I eat now. So the home of the chicken wings, the Anchor Steam Bar. Anchor Bar, not Steam. And Toronto was not that far away. And I went to Toronto and had one of those revelatory moments, culinary. And so I ordered coffee, and it was a coffee from Hawaii, and it was served tableside in a 3-foot vacuum, which I had never seen before. So they bring out a giant 2 beakers. One is filled with water. One has ground coffee on the top. They light a candle. The water boils. It goes up. They turn off. They turn out the temperature, and it goes back down.
What year was this?
This was Buffalo is in the 70s.
This must have been revolutionary. Yeah. This is 40 years before the third wave coffee.
Well, this was historical, so European, okay. Let's say, where there, and later on, as the sort of coffee world began to recognize, there's a country known as Japan, where everything in Japan is done at an extraordinary high level, and so now the pour over sort of came in this iteration. It's an interesting balance because the idea of the pour over actually was the Melita family were the first people to use paper filters to make coffee, and that was a very long time ago. And then in the new wave of coffee, third, fourth, or fifth, or tidal, whichever, a Japanese glass company known for making tea. And you'll see that much if you stop to watch the coffee. In that experience of a pour-over made to you, really culturally comes out of this tea ceremony in Japan. Because on the Melita side, it was about efficiency, it was about effective, it was paper was available as opposed to metal, let's say, and that's where in Europe pour-over. The Melita family say they sort of invented the format, and then it was taken to a art form in Japan by the Hario company.
So tell us about that experience in Toronto, having this coffee made in this very elaborate contraption.
I had never tasted coffee like that ever in my whole life.
What did it taste like?
It tasted just 100% correct. And so, you know, coffee, and still coffee is treated, let's say, had been treated generally, well, no, actually, historically, there was only commodity coffee in those days. And so the selection process, every aspect of the specialty coffee world, which we're part of, versus the commodity world, it's the difference between night and day. So, you know, the specialty coffee as a collective worldwide has established criteria in order for coffee to fit into that category. And generally, it's a numerical value. So coffee, 80 points or higher in when it's cupped.
Graded on a 100-point scale.
Graded on a 100-point scale, but, and this might be a little shocking, my next statement. In the inside the industry, there is no coffee scoring higher than the highest 80 that you can come up with. That even when you get into the coffee scoring, let's say 87, 88, 89, coffees that move into that category and then into the, let's say, stratosphere with no gravity, I will describe it as, coffees in the 90s, generally, the first and foremost noticeable difference is they do not taste like coffee.
So what do they taste like?
They taste like, I don't know, the melon that we had for lunch. It could be tomatoes that were in part of the food that we ate. I mean, just imagine anything that you've ever experienced in your nose, through your nose, and in your mouth. Anything. Everything.
What do you think that says about the coffee industry, that the top-graded coffees don't taste like coffee, don't taste like what we expect coffee to taste like?
I think it's... We're in a great moment. That's why you have your show. It's because we're in a moment where there's an audience for things, an appreciation, let's say, for the entire experience. So, starting from the ground up, and from farming perspective, from never before science and farming, always hand in hand, but never sort of like in this light moment that we're in now, where varietals, coffee was grown, well, I digress, which I love to do. We'll start by saying, coffee, not unlike humanity, came from the same origin, from Ethiopia. And there's lots of stories about who it was that was willing to sort of, you know, like in the old days, when people came across something that looked edible, but no one had never seen anybody eat it. Who's the first person either...
Popped a coffee cherry in their mouth and...
To just like say, oh yeah, I would like to taste that. And so, you know, in our industry, there's a story. They talk about, because in Ethiopia, they are, let's say, agricultural based. They're shepherds. So a shepherd by the name, oddly enough, of Kaldi, was out with his goats one day, and the story, as I first heard it, but then I sort of put my little slant on it. So he watched the goats eat the fruit, because coffee, let's start, is a fruit. It's the seeds. What we use as coffee are the seeds, generally two inside, a fruit that looks like the cherry that we eat that has a single solid, has usually two seeds. Those seeds can either be planted in the ground and grow into the tree and yield fruit, or they can be processed. And so Kaldi, he knows nothing of this at the time. And so so he sees the goats, they're standing on their feet, because coffee, when grown wild, actually can grow up to like 30 feet. So they were probably hooves on shoulders on the way up, eating the fruit. And he takes a nap, And he wakes up and they are dancing. And maybe, but I like to say, same thing, hooves on shoulders, eating the fruit. He falls asleep. He wakes up. They are not dead. And he said, this I will try. And so the idea of picking fruit, of turning it into some kind of tea, boiling it, because I imagine there was fire and there were vessels, and I imagine people quickly learn that raw is good, but maybe you might want to just take it a little easy and see if the first cooking, you know, imagine, as you could imagine, the first people who went from raw to use fire.
The coffee cherry is a little bit sweet, sort of mildly sweet, but not a very compelling flavor.
Well, in the context that we now have culinary cherries, the Bing and cousins, the Rainier, you know, the vocabulary, that there is a vocabulary for cherries along with everything else, you know, grown at with, I mean, I'm speechless, but those, while having some flavor, you know, the bite through is not, it's
not particularly pleasant.
It is not pleasant.
It could be sort of a chalky or a gummy texture.
It has texture, yes. And so, but, you know, life is hard back in Caldy's day.
Yeah.
And fire had, I guess, recently been discovered, and people, the keeper of the flame, the concept, and what's interesting about Ethiopia, for those non-geography, it is literally one can walk through the water from Ethiopia to Yemen. And the difference at that time between, let's say, the agricultural Ethiopians and the Yemens, because of the contact, what we like in my story, in the port of Mocha,
Which is actually a place.
Which
in
is
Yemen.
A place in Yemen, yeah. And it is not a kind of chocolate. It has K's instead of C, and so spices from around the world, because people were out on the. So my story, sort of the coffee story, starts for me. We've superseded Caldy. Coffee is now being transacted into Yemen. We're into the 1500s, maybe late 1400s. There are what were, when I was growing up, described as explorers out on the ocean. They were not really explorers. They were pirates, always pirates, and bumping into countries along the way, bumping into other countries on the water. And if some of the things that I've read is true, I'm putting it out there, and anyone can write to Ethan and say, that guy made all this stuff up. Perhaps.
They can write to you.
Right. So the Chinese, who had been out on the oceans, sort of had encountered everybody else. So the Italians were out there, the Spanish were out there, the Portuguese were out there, the Dutch were out there, French were out there, the English were out. Everybody's out on the water, and everybody's like, and the Chinese sees all of these Europeans, and they go, we are done with it. They pull all their boats off the water, and they say, we will build the bridge, the wall. And they put up the wall, the great wall of China.
Well, so let's fast forward 500 years or so to the Brooklyn Roasting Company.
Oh, sorry.
I think the history of coffee and the history of global trade is fascinating.
I told you I would digress.
So let's get back on track to Brooklyn and to coffee in
specialty world in 2010 and
well, and also I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that you did before.
Yes.
You were in the video rental business.
Yes.
For quite a while.
Yes, I was a pioneer.
So
second video rental store in the Manhattan.
And Berlin. you also hosted a children's radio show.
Radio station for the Board of Ed, WNYE 91.5, produced 40 hours of original children's programming for many, many, many years.
So what were some of the lessons that you learned from those two almost entirely independent careers that you had that you have now applied to Brooklyn Roasting over the last 10 years?
Oh, absolutely nothing.
Totally unrelated.
I mean, everything is related, but,
Are there?
Well, let's just say, I'll tell you, I will actually. The thing that I have learned and the thing that I have tried to impart to most of the employees that have worked with us. So I describe it as the most powerful word in the world, which is the word yes. And so the willingness to say yes is when things happen. And so, you know, every time I was sort of presented with something, instead of like saying, let me think about that, my immediate reaction for all of these things that were presented to me was the word yes. And yes is the word that takes you places. And no, literally, as I like to say, gets you nowhere. And so when I used to engage with new staff members and ask them what it was that brought them, most people who came to work for us in the early days were not people who were born and raised in New York. And so they came to New York, usually with a dream of doing something else. And so I would tell them two things. One, if you want to be trained as a barista, it's a fantastic world. It's an unbelievable skill. It's a skill that you can take anywhere in the world, and you can find work if you want to. Akin to when I was younger, I used to say the same thing about physical therapists, that skill and talent, I had a small world. So the physical therapist could go anywhere and get work. And baristas, as we've discovered, can actually go anywhere in the world. Where they can get into, when they can get into wherever they go, can work. And so I would say, if you want to use the word no, put a K at the front and a W at the end, because that is a no that has heft to it. And everyone should want to always know more.
We're going to take a quick break, and we will be back in
2 minutes. Loosen our seatbelts.
Yeah, right. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Botanic Garden, a stunning 52-acre garden in the heart of Brooklyn, featuring spectacular plant displays and inspiring public programs year-round. Harvest Homecoming, an old-school fall foliage festival, comes to Brooklyn Botanic Garden on Sunday, October 20th. Celebrate cider season with New York cider houses and kombucha makers, bringing hard and soft ciders and fermented drinks to try or buy. A pop-up farmers market will feature heritage apples from local orchards. Groove to the sounds of fresh Americana music and world beats throughout the day. Bring your friends and family and make a day of it with hay rides, lawn games, a children's Halloween costume parade, and more, all in the heart of Brooklyn. Learn more about Brooklyn Botanic Garden at bbg.org.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Linda Liu, and I'm the host of Feast Meets West, the show that celebrates Asian culture through the lens of food here on HRN. Listen to episodes like The Evolution of Chinatown with Num Wah Tea Parlor's Wilson Tang and New York Times' Elaine Chen. Catch our ongoing series, Women in Asian Food, and spotlight episodes with our heroes like Anita Lowe. You can find Feast Meets West wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back. You're listening to Why Food, and our guest this week is Michael Pollack, who is the original roaster of the Brooklyn Roasting Company and an expert and opinionated person on many subjects.
Yes.
One of the things that I want to make sure we touch on.
Yes.
We'll need to have you back because there's a lot to talk about. I want to talk about
Ethan. As you recall, I used to produce 40 hours of original programming. So
constraining
single hours
is just not your style,
right? Yeah, right.
Next time we'll do an 8-hour yes, interview.
The marathon. Right.
One of the things I want to make sure we talk about is the relationship between coffee and climate change, which is significant and maybe one of the ways that people's lives are being touched most immediately, both coffee drinkers and coffee farmers,
yes,
are being touched most immediately by the effects of climate change. But something that I think most coffee drinkers have no idea about. So tell us about that.
So coffee, basically, there are two different varietals. So there's Robusta, highly caffeinated, much more caffeine in Robusta than in the Arabica coffee. And the Arabica coffee generally, this is where the science, I could open myself up to criticism here, but the Arabica actually came, all the coffees that would come from Yemen, let's say, because Ethiopia, and then when as I was talking about the people on the ocean, so the Dutch sort of bumped in while traveling, bumped into Indonesia. Everyone, once coffee sort of made it to Europe, getting plants and having plants be on board ships, because coffee, believe it or not, not unlike Caldi's experience, once he drank it, realize that coffee contains probably at that time and maybe even in this day and age has a the most powerful drug in the world. It's known as caffeine, and it changes people. So as I said, in 1500s life was hard and people were drunk. They lived the fermented life. And then coffee, which is, let's say, has the clarity, the keeps you, can keep you awake. And when you're awake, not unlike what we're doing here, people have a tendency to converse. And so actually people stopping being drunk and drinking coffee and communicating for the first time. And so, you know, I'm going to put it out there. The Age of Enlightenment is tied into drinking coffee, because it was the first, and that's why it became treasured by all of the countries that had the wherewithal and contact with coast to send ships out to find places to plant coffee. And so all of the countries ended up bumping into, they didn't have GPS, they didn't have, so they would bump into things, and that would be land masses, and they would claim it, and they would try to plant, and successful in some places, not successful in others. And when it was successful, you know, depending on where in the world they were coming back from, either they went directly to their own countries, back to their own countries, so the Spaniards and the Italians and the Portuguese, and the Dutch and the English and the French, and coffee came along for the ride. And
and
most of the science in coffee came out of the institutes and gardens in France and in England, where they have been studying the science of coffee for the longest time. But now every sort of place in the world has their own sort of headquarters, and so much study that's going on in coffee from an agricultural perspective, on the caffeine side, the learning to bring origins from different places, what I told you about, the geishing of coffee, all kinds of crazy things. So, you know, countries used to be specific in the kind of trees that grew there and the kind of fruit that came from there. But we live in sort of an open sourcing world, although it's not exactly supposed to be open. But trees, plant seeds from other origins can be brought and have been brought into other origins to take qualities from, let's just say, on the agricultural side, not to mention the ability to deliver different taste sensations. So taking seeds from one, let's say from Ethiopia, and somehow ending up in Panama, when I talk about the geisha world, and that sort of special moment that took place, I think in the 80s, when the first fruits were put on, maybe late 70s, early 80s, when that final fruit, those coffee beans were put on a table and cupped, it was, I would say, the first time 100 points was given to a coffee in a world that is capped in the 80s.
Yeah.
Because, you know, what you get traditionally from Panama's in flavor notes, it's the chocolates, you know, all of those body, a little brightness, but not the acidity that we get these days, compared to a coffee from Ethiopia, which is a rainbow of flavors and tastes, and particularly if the coffee is allowed to dry naturally, the sun-dried coffees, that's when all of those flavors that come from the history of humanity in Ethiopia actually make their way into the coffee bean and into the cup, and people will taste things, and you know, every coffee brewed in a cup looks exactly the same. It's either hot or cold, it's brown, and there's no way to tell what it is that it's going to taste like until you taste it. Yeah. And the range, you know, we have in our industry, a flavor wheel of all of the, you know, when we train, there's a technical training where there's 36 aromas for people to train, hundreds of cups of coffee that you taste and test and score to sort of calibrate your palate. When in Korea, they came up with their own sort of tasting guide, training material. And in that kit, they have 100 different fragrances because, you know, when you think the nasal, and the I'll keep going, even though I see you're scared.
Well, let's talk. I want to make sure we talk about climate change, the relationship between between this movement of coffee around the world.
Yeah, I know. It's so hard to talk. Okay, so climate change is...
Well, coffee
is... We are a victim.
And there's we're in a very particular moment for coffee right now. The commodity price is the lowest it's been in almost a decade.
That is correct.
Unsustainably low. Farmers are leaving fruit on the plants because it's not...
It does not pay to pick. That is correct.
And then that crisis is connected to immigration. Farmers are leaving farms in Guatemala and throughout Central America. And
not without a challenge, correct.
Making their way north. It connects into fires in the Amazon, which I think you have some opinions about. What's the connection between all of this and how does it affect the coffee roaster and the coffee drinker?
Well, imagine anyone who farms would be able to, relates to not that weather is predictable, but seasons, they were called seasons for a reason. And so in origins and places in the world that had, because of where they are located on the planet, a variety of seasons. There are places when it's warm all the time, which is good for coffee. The coffee that most everyone who's listening to you probably is drinking is Arabica, grown at high altitude. And you need to have a rain when you need rain, so that the unbelievable, one day you should travel to origin when coffee is flowering.
Yeah.
And it's like being in what used to be, what the Alps used to look like, or any place that was
incredible.
Covered in snow.
I was in Vietnam earlier this year during when the coffee plants were flowering. It was
so not just visual, but the fragrance that comes from the flowers is extraordinary. I mean, it's amazing. And but you need, in order to get to fruit, you need consistent temperature. You need rain to sort of be not a deluge. And so that's just on the growing side. On the processing side, in most countries, smaller origins where everything is done by hand, you know, coffee is traditionally had been put out on patios to dry. And the unpredictability of climate and rain. So now anyone who does anything on the ground has tarps set up so that if the rain comes, they can do it. And most places that have the benefit of success, or as I like to say, are part of fair trade cooperatives. So my first trip to Peru, I was there when, and all the coffee comes on from one mountain in Peru, in northern Peru. And on the way up, you sort of go through cacao, and usually in a little village town, there's a giant cacao plant in the middle of town. And then you keep going up to where coffee comes from. And so All of the farmers in the cooperative, with the extra money that they got after the coffee had been come down and they got the, you know, how it was processed, how it was cut, how it was scored, all of those things in this particular cooperative, for everything that comes in at what's required or above, there's more money on the farming side. So organic, you get more money. Moisture content in what we call Pergamino, still in hull, if it comes in at a certain level where they don't have to put it out on a patio to continue to dry, there's more money. And then in the cup, depending on its score, more money. And then when it goes out to market, then the cooperative members decide if there's money left behind, if everyone's got paid and the schools are and all the, everyone is taken care of. If there's extra money, they get to vote on what to do with it. And they had voted to put in place a mechanical dryer. So I was there when the first mechanical dryer was put in place in this cooperative known as Soli Cafe. My second trip, which was 3 years later, they had seven mechanical dryers around the mountain just because two things. One, consistent, unpredictable weather, and at the same time, consistent, unbelievable success as farmers. So they recognize that for them to grow as a cooperative, each farm to be able to produce more so that all those families would make more money, to instead of having just strategic, as many different touch points so that it would happen quicker and bring coffee down the mountain faster, that's what they voted on. And so, you know, climate, we're, you know, at the mercy of the changing climate.
Yeah, and we've seen this with spice farmers too.
Yes.
Rainy seasons coming early, coming late, running long, cutting short. The cycles that farmers have built their whole careers on are changing very quickly.
Yes.
And because of the nature of any, I think, any commoditized international supply chain oriented industry, fluctuations, volatility in price, just they go all over the place.
And, yeah, and I mean, farmers can't, you know, when we buy coffee on contracts, because actually we've grown, so we're able to predict, and we need to make sure that we have supply. We actually take delivery. You know, the commodity market, when I say the market, the transaction, it is probably, because for the longest time, I used to say it was the second largest traded commodity in the world, behind oil. Yeah. But I actually believe the transactions, it's probably back up there again. But most people never take delivery. It's just another investment opportunity. And so you have
moving
people hedging up and down.
Futures and
all kinds of stuff.
Well, so let's talk about the Amazon.
The Portuguese, and I mean nothing but love to the people from Portugal. But the history of Portugal is, if you don't know it, you should look into the, it's remarkable. I mean, there was a time when Portugal ruled the world.
Yeah.
And they were fierce on the water. And somehow, whenever they encountered anybody who had land somewhere else, they would say, no, I'm sorry, this is our land now. And they would leave really strong nonverbal examples of why people wanted to leave and say, please take it. And one of the things, while people were exiting, so Ethiopia somehow became a country where they speak Portuguese, and then Brazil. And Brazil and coffee is what we call night and day. And so the amount Brazil produces, I would say, more coffee than the next, and everybody else. As you talk about Vietnam, actually it's the second largest producing country in the world. They produce mostly Robusta coffee, but they're looking to sort of raise that quality, and so they're playing with Arabica as well.
This is Brazil or Vietnam?
Vietnam.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in Brazil, they grow whatever you want.
Yeah.
Whatever you want, we grow it, because they have, or they used to have, a lot of land.
Yeah.
And there was land, and then, you know, there's a region in Brazil where, and as you saw, You know, most, as I said, coffee high altitude, grown on mountains in Brazil, because they're wild. So they would level mountains, and because it's easier to farm. And there's a region known as Cerrado where, if I'm not mistaken, coffee is never touched by hand. That there's machines, basically the, I'd say the size of where we are and what's outside, where someone sits probably 40 feet in the high.
We're in a repurposed shipping container, so give or take the size of a,
I'd say like
a tractor trailer truck.
But wide.
Okay.
And so they plant. So they have machines that plant. They have machines that harvest with analytics that are going on. So every piece of fruit that gets picked gets analyzed at a scale that, like, unbelievably amazing to see. And then you go like, wow. Which leads us to the forest fires. And so, which is different because the forest fires, and I, you know, so I say to every, listen, burning down the Amazon, I'm not a fan of burning down the Amazon. I recognize the importance. I just find it a little strange that, you know, when everybody else has sort of knocked down anything that has gotten in the way of progress, that at the same dream of anyone finding a piece of land and starting to grow things is like, that's humanity. And, you know, listen, there are fewer and fewer patches where that exists. But, you know, the idea that people need lids for their cups of coffee, people, you know, all of the things that we take for granted, you know, is part of what, you know, I would imagine that this was a forest not too long ago.
Yeah. Well, and recognizing the complicity, you know, the United States as being the biggest country of consumers,
yes,
in the world,
yes,
putting pressure on producers in, yes, in countries without the same resources, without the same options. Yeah, I mean, we are...
It's complex.
Yeah, it's definitely... And it's challenging. It's like, how do we, as consumers... I'm sitting here drinking a glass of iced coffee,
but
as
But you're
we
drinking
speak.
It out of a glass.
I'm drinking it out of a glass, but
and
I'm still...
And you don't have a straw.
I don't.
And so, and that act is revolutionary in this modern age. I mean, at Brooklyn Roasting, we have tried to do cup exchange programs,
yeah,
7 times.
Yeah.
With no traction in the marketplace.
Why do you think that was? Or what's happening now that there is traction where there wasn't before?
There's people... I'll tell you... I'm going to get myself in trouble. But traction is someone coming in with their own cup.
Yeah.
That's traction. Because even if it's ceramic and we have to clean it, fine. We do that. But there's no reason that we should be doing that.
Yeah.
Take ownership. That's all I'm saying. That people should come with their own cups. They should say, the thing I like every time, they keep me out of everything because I'm a little, you know, I didn't want to have lids. I didn't want to have them out. I wanted people to ask for them. And then I wanted people, if I would give you a lid if you used it for a week. And then at the end of the week, I would give you a free cup of coffee. That's what I wanted to do, just to get people into the idea of thinking differently about their own lives and what, in the smallest manner, what they can do that will change the climate and can change the world.
And you're providing coffee for a rally tomorrow, part,
yes,
of the UN General Assembly.
At Battery Park.
A climate change rally.
Climate change. We're going crazy for Greta. We're giving away coffee.
Well, so what responsibility do you feel as not only a business owner, but also someone who deals in an international commodity based on agriculture and connected to the clearing of land in places like Brazil? How does that all fit together?
Well, so it's difficult. It's difficult to say where in the world, you know, it's humanity. And so, depending on where in the world, the dream for someone to find a piece of land to be able to grow something, yeah, not just for themselves and their family, but that actually And we live in a sort of a really great moment. Probably the we live in the, let's just say, the best time ever in the world, even though it's difficult. But just the idea that people, so many people, and particularly everybody who's enjoying this, you know, all of this, where the corn on the pizza came from, you know, the zucchini, the, you know, everything, everybody knows, not necessarily the exact farmer, and maybe doesn't know exactly what goes on the farm. They know the farmers or the name of a farm. And, you know, for every product, I imagine, that comes through in and out of Roberta's, I could say it, that there's a chain of custody. There's an understanding of who the makers were for the ingredients. So things are sourced with a connection to the people who make things. And that's important. And anybody who wants to go into that arena, because it's farming, as if you speak to anyone who farms, it is a hard life. And yet people are willing to sort of give up whatever to go do it, because there's something, there's some unbelievable level of satisfaction to sort of growing things. And most people don't ever get that as an opportunity, even though everyone does have that as an opportunity. And we live in a world where actually you don't even need land to grow, that you can grow in water. And the idea that people who consume would not even, I mean, everybody thinks about it. It's not that hard to get an aeroponic garden that would deliver. Yes, it's not going to see, it's not going to, in everything that you grow, you can't, or that you eat, you can't grow. But anything that you do grow makes everything else easier for everybody else.
So to wrap up, we don't have another 7 hours to talk today. We'll have to set that up for the next time. But I mean, what are your thoughts on entrepreneurship and starting a business? You've done it several times, done it quite successfully in totally different, unrelated industries.
Yes,
starting from zero and getting maybe to 89, because that's the scale that you work on in coffee. Any last sort of bits of advice or insight that you might have for a listener who's thinking about making a career change themselves?
Go for it.
Okay.
The only thing you have to lose if it doesn't work out, it's not time. It's the attention. And, you know, success is, let's say, it's not always succeeding. It's trying and solving, and in some cases, I mean, so, you know, as I told you before, when we started Brooklyn Roasting, I was alone roasting the coffee while my business partner and the people that work with us were out selling, and then they'd come back to pack it to deliver. And when we started delivering, we had a cargo bicycle, and we, for the first, when we were doing service calls, we actually had these really talented, unbelievably gifted bicycle riders and technical. And so they used to, I mean, espresso machines and a cargo bike and water heaters, all kinds of stuff. And so we've always been sort of forward thinking about the climate. But the willingness to just try, and there's no such thing as failure, because if it doesn't succeed, you learn something. And the willingness to try, to attempt. If you need help, there are so many people who are doing the thing that you want to learn how to do that would be just the happiest people to talk about what they do and are helpful. So, yeah, go for it.
Michael, thank you. It's been a real pleasure spending this time with you today. Just briefly, where can our listeners find you, find your coffee, pick up a cup, pick up a pound?
So we package, I'll tell you. So we package in 12-ounce...
pick up 12 ounces.
Cans.
Okay.
Cans came from two things. One, the most recyclable material in the world, and we encourage people to reuse them, and we give them more coffee if they come back to our cafes and reuse them. So brooklynroasting.com, we sell through the internet. We have stores in Brooklyn. We have stores in Manhattan. We have stores in Japan. We're out there. And... J Street, I've gone back to start roasting again at J Street, so I'm doing stages there. Happy to welcome anybody. You can watch most people have never seen coffee roasted. who can watch coffee getting roasted. We serve it 1,000 ways till Sunday.
Great. Thank you very much. And as always, you can...
I warned you, right? I told you.
As always, you can reach us, whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org. You can reach me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram. Valerie is having her adventures in Paris and Oregon. Follow her at Foodie in New York. And
I thought you said this was an hour.
No,
I'm kidding you.
And
like 5 minutes.
You interrupted my pattern. Now, what was I going to say next? Oh, thanks to Amanda, our awesome sound engineer.
Yes, Amanda, you've been amazing.
And to the Red Crickets for our theme song, which is Blind. See you next week.
Why Food is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.